Hi, I'm Tammy, and I'm a grateful recovering addict.
Hey, Tammy.
I'm grateful to be here today, and I'm really grateful to be back home, and I always say that whenever I share, because, like, Art shared that I was one of the lost sheep from here. I came here, I was very involved with service. I got clean here, and I moved away to New Jersey, and I'm just coming back home. I went through a lot of stuff, but I didn't use, and I continued my journey of recovery, and here I am. And I'm really grateful for everything. You know, it's been trying since I came back home. Been looking for a job. I've been looking for a lot of, you know, just security. And coming from a place where I had everything in New Jersey and leaving everything in New Jersey to come back and starting over is very humbling, very humbling. But it can be done. And, you know, I'll share about that, what happened with that and everything. But I just want to tell you a little bit about who I was and who I am. I'm not going to dwell on who I was because I think we all know, or we wouldn't be here, you know, and I don't think that that's a message of recovery for me to stand here and dwell on who I was. I came here by way of a facility in the Altoona area, and I didn't get it because I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to be in relationships, and I wanted to teeter on the fence and still shoplift and still do all the behaviors that I did when I was out there using, and I wanted to stay clean at the same time, I thought, but I found out that I really didn't want to stay clean because I went back out. And I came to the meetings for a while, and that first time around was when I met Rich, and it's funny to see him now and to stand here the person I am today, like knowing who I was back then. And he was my like emergency person, you know. My first phone call after I got out of the inpatient facility was to the NA helpline, because somebody in the facility gave me a paper that had the NA helpline number. And, well, I had lost it, but I remembered about it. And I looked up something in the phone book. I called somebody. Long story short, they gave me the NA helpline number. Somehow I ended up with it, and I called, and Rich answered the phone, and I didn't know him. All I knew was I came home. My mom had pain pills in the medicine cabinet. I opened the medicine cabinet looking for them. I found them, and it freaked me out because I didn't want to use. And I called the helpline, and Rich answered the phone and told me where there was a meeting and told me, well, I'm going to be at the meeting too. So I went, and I saw him there. And then a couple weeks later, like, I was listening to what everybody was sharing about getting clean and people, places, and things and changing all this stuff. And I went to Rich with all of my phone numbers and handed them to him. Because somebody, I was at the store, and somebody gave me a number, and I handed them to Rich, and I was like, I don't know what to do. I feel like calling these people, and Rich ripped them up in front of me, and he said, well, you won't need these anymore. And I said, okay, I guess that's the value of one addict helping another, you know, because I couldn't do it on my own. But when I saw him, I always just was drawn to him for help. And I'm grateful to be here, like I said, and to see the people that are here. I didn't get it, like, the first time, or the second time, or the third time, or the fourth time. I got it my ninth time, my ninth try at recovery, 9 rehabs, outpatients, inpatients, whatever. And I found out that the responsibility was with me. Like, no matter how many times I went to treatment, if I wasn't going to get it, I wasn't going to get it, because if I wasn't willing to stop using, then if I didn't have a desire, I was lost, you know. So the last time around, it led me to the state penitentiary, and I always share I'm not built for the penitentiary. I'm not. I thought I was. I thought it was really cool. I was going upstate. That's where everybody went. It was really, but that's the sickness in our heads. You know, that's the way I was thinking. Like, everybody goes upstate. Yeah, I'm going there now, too. Until I got there, and it was no fun anymore. You know, and I had called my mother. I was on the phone with her. And when the judge sentenced me to 2 years upstate, she had told me that she felt like God was intervening. And I listened. I just stepped back from the podium whenever she gave me my sentence and told me that God was intervening. She asked me if I had anything to say, and I had all this stuff planned to say, but whenever she said that, I stepped back and shut up, because I knew in my heart that something was different this time. And I had to do treatment in the prison, and I didn't realize I had a problem until my behaviors while I was locked up took me to some of the same depths and despair that I had an active addiction without even using a drug. You know, I signed out of rehab behind a relationship, gave up my release date from the state penitentiary, and then I realized once I was out in general population and lost my release date, something was wrong. And something was wrong here. This is the only place where I could fix it, was here. So I had to beg to get back into the program. Luckily, they gave me my release date back, but I made a 6-month inpatient, a 9-month inpatient, you know, because of my rebelliousness. And after that, I was done. I was talking to somebody, to a couple people that rode up here with me about, you know, feeling like I was totally done whenever I had hit the penitentiary. That was it for me. And I started taking suggestions then. They had suggested that I get out and get a sponsor. In the meantime, I'm in prison for 2 years, and everything that I had heard at NA meetings is still churning through my head, because, like, we come here to carry a message. That's why I'm here today, is to carry a message. And the things that I heard people share whenever they were speaking were still going through my head, because I still wanted to get it. I still wanted to get clean. I wanted to recover. I was remembering the people I saw in meetings, the things that they said to me, the hope that they gave me, and I knew that there was another way. And the director of this facility I was in there was an NA member, so there was no way around not going to meetings, because she created meetings in the facility 7 days a week, and we had to go 7 days a week. And they suggested that I get a sponsor, but it wasn't until I got gut-level honest with me about all the things, all that stuff that I had locked up on the inside of me that I swore I would take to my grave and I wasn't going to share with anybody. I started sharing it then. And when I started doing that, that's when things started to turn around for me and I gained that little sense of hope. And then I got out when I was supposed to, and my mother would not let me come home. And she said, you have to do 6 more months of something, because you have to have a year clean before you come home, because I had really, really, really hurt my mother. And that's part of my hope story, too, my mother. But I had really burnt all my bridges with everybody, so I went to York to a halfway house, and I got my first real sponsor, because I had sponsors by name, and I didn't call them. And I didn't think that I had to do what everybody else had to do. I thought I just had to say I had a sponsor and I was cool, I could get out of treatment, and I was just going to stay clean for the rest of my life. And that worked for about a week every time. It didn't work. So I got a sponsor for real this time, and I started to embark on the journey of the 12 steps, and it's the best thing that I could have ever done for my life. I did the first step with my sponsor out there. And I was still in a halfway house. And I was a client nobody wanted to have, because my behaviors were, like, out there. I mean, I was I was out there. And I started writing on the 12th step. I wrote on the 12th step, got with my sponsor, and I wanted to share on the 12th step. Well, all of a sudden, these other behaviors, or the first step, I mean, all of a sudden these other behaviors started coming out, and I called my sponsor in a state of urgency, because I had gotten locked in the halfway house because of my behaviors. They took my car. I had to walk 6 miles to work and walk 6 miles back, and couldn't figure out why. And she said, well, maybe you want to write the first step on that stuff too. you know, so I said, do you think so? She's like, yeah. So I sat down and I wrote it out, and then more stuff came out. And I wrote my first step, I know, four times at least until I was finished finally with a thorough first step. And I shared it with my sponsor, and it didn't feel good because that was the admission of who I was. That was the admission of all the things that I had done. But there was a piece in the first step, the spiritual principle of humility, and I remember that was my favorite part of the first step. When I got to the end of the step working guide, or the first step in the step working guide, and it said that the spiritual principle is humility, and like that we learn that we're A, not a monster that poisoned the whole earth, and B, not the best thing on the face of the earth either, you know, and we kind of meet ourselves in the middle and realize that we're human, you know. And that's what happened to me with my first step, you know, and on to the second step, which to me was the step of hope. And there's a sentence in the step working guide in the beginning of the second step about the first step has left a vacuum in our lives. And I remember feeling that vacuum, like I felt totally empty, like totally void, null, nothing there, like just depleted after I shared my first step with my sponsor. And then came the second step where I was able to fill that void, and that void was not filled immediately. And it took, I had CDs from events like this that I used to play all the time, everywhere I went, in my car, coming to and from wherever, in the halfway house, out of the halfway house, walking down the road, I was listening to something about recovery. You know, I was just trying to fill myself up with something that was going to last, because the things that I was grabbing a hold of to fill myself up with never lasted. You know, like the nice looking guy didn't last, the drug didn't last, the behaviors, the shoplifting, you know, yeah, it made me feel good for a period of time, but then what? When the consequences came, I couldn't handle them, you know, and I couldn't handle how I felt in my spirit whenever I was doing things like that. So I worked the second step thoroughly with a sponsor also, and I was thorough with all of my steps. But the funniest thing was that the steps, my life aligned with the steps of every step that I was on. So every step that I was on, the situation that I was facing in my life matched up with the step and the spiritual principles that I needed at that time. And that always happens to me. It always happens. And that's how I know that I'm doing the right thing, is because whenever this stuff starts to come in my life, if I pick the book up and I read the spiritual principles, which are outlined very clearly in It Works, How, and Why, the Green and Gold book, if I look at the spiritual principles, I can see why I'm going through what I'm going through, and I don't have to always say, God, why me? You know, because the answer is, God, why not? You know, if the answer is, why not you? That's God's answer back to me, you know, like, I chose you, so go through it. And, you know, I went on to a third step and made that decision, which was one of the most important decisions that I ever made in my life. And it says that in the basic text, but I guess we really know it and feel it whenever we make that decision, you know, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And my experience with that was I went to my brother because I was in this relationship in Harrisburg, and I didn't want to move back home when I was on my third step. And I had my life planned. Everything that was supposed to happen, I just knew it was supposed to happen. And my sponsor told me, Tammy wants to do what Tammy wants to do right now. And I'm like, no. I think this is God's will for my life, right? And then the person brought me home from Harrisburg to transfer my parole there from Harrisburg, or Altoona to Harrisburg, and they never came back. And there I was on the third step, and I remember, like, the refusal, not the denial, but the refusal to accept the fact that I had to apply this stuff. And, like, I was in this house, and the furnace had blown up in the house. The walls were black. The only thing in, because the furnace exploded, you know, the only thing in the house was a day bed from, like, I don't know, maybe 1960 or 1970. It was old. It was an older piece of furniture, and there was a phone. My car broke down in Harrisburg. It was sitting alongside the road getting ready to get towed, and I was 30 miles from any meeting. And I remember people telling me when I was in York that, like, I had to go to any lengths to get my recovery. So I started making phone calls, and I found a way to go to about 4 or 5 meetings a week without a car, 30 miles away from my house, you know, because people showed up for me. People were there for me. And they would come to my house. They would drive 30 miles to get to my house, pick me up, drive me to the meeting, and then drive me home and not expect anything. And, well, those were the people I chose to hang out with because there were people that had expectations. But I didn't choose to hang out with those people because I had just been, I was really hurt and I was really being humbled. And I remember saying to my brother, like, my biggest fear in the third step was, what if God's will is not what I want? And my brother looked at me, and he's in recovery too. He was one of these people, like, I always wanted to get my brother clean with me, and I would go to his house and, like, NA this and NA that. So he thought I was a cop, you know, and he kicked me out of his house, and, like, it wouldn't work. Like, I couldn't get my brother clean. And then the funny thing is, whenever I got clean, a month later, my brother got clean on his own. You know, just from me just stepping away and leading by example. Like, I don't have to make him, and I can't make him get clean, you know. But my brother said to me, when are you going to realize that God loves you? I was like, huh, how about that? So I started looking around at my surroundings, and it's kind of a situation like I'm in now. When I came back to Altoona then, I had like two and a half years clean. And there weren't a lot of women with a lot of clean time in the rooms. And I was open. And I remember that moment of clarity when I realized that maybe God's purpose was a lot bigger than what mine was, and maybe I was supposed to, like, get my head out of my ass and start helping the women. And that's why God brought me back to Altoona, like he did that time and this time. But this time is a little different. But so, yeah, I was here for a while. I was involved in service. You know, I did a 4-step while I was here. I had gotten another sponsor. I have to be, you know, being totally honest, I've had more than one sponsor. I think I had 3 sponsors in my journey through the steps. And one did 1, 2, and 3 with me, or 1 and 2 with me in York. One here did 3. And then one in Massachusetts did 4 through 7. And the one I have now did 7 through 12 with me. You know, so that was my journey through the 12 steps, because what I found out about sponsorship was that, like, sometimes there was a time when I had a need to move on, you know, and that sponsor that I had in York, she drove hours to come and see me, you know, and I really appreciated that. But whenever she started doing things that she was teaching me that you just don't do in NA, and you know, I tried to be there for her, but I was to the point, I was still very needy. I was very needy myself, and she wasn't meeting my needs, and I was very self-centered, too. So if I look back on that, like, I could blame her for everything and why I left, but really, I was really needy. And I had to move on to somebody who had the time for me, and she taught me how to not be so needy, but that was only through the fetal position in a 4-step. And many, many tears and many, many nights and hours on the phone with her. Like, I went through interferon treatment on my 4-step, and I was working in a treatment facility because my whole plan was, like, yeah, I'm clean, I'm on a 4-step, now I can work in treatment. And it'll be good for everybody. And it wasn't good for the people that I worked with. Not my coworkers, the clients. Because, like, I was still a very sick person, you know, and I got this job, and I'm working this job, and I'm working like 80 hours a week and overnights and all kind of stuff for like 3 years straight in this position, and, you know, going through my 4-step, and going through a 4-step while I was working in treatment wasn't good for me. I don't know, it might be good for somebody else, but for me it really wasn't. Funny, hindsight is always 20/20 whenever you look back and you think, well, what would I have done different, you know? But that was my journey, and I guess that things had to happen the way they did for things to be the way they are now. And anyway, so I got fired from that job and finished the four step. And I got fired, I have to say, over my behaviors once again. That rebelliousness came in, and thought I could do whatever I wanted to do, and I didn't have anybody to answer to. Clean, working at a job, and they fired me because I wasn't in charge. And that was humbling because I had to go back to being a waitress after working in treatment for 3 years and starting college. So that was difficult. I shared my fifth step. Well, the fourth step got me in touch with all those patterns, those unhealthy patterns that I had that I would repeat over and over and over again. And I remember right now my fourth step, and I called my sponsor. I had this epiphany, and I was like, wow. There were some times when I lied, and I thought I didn't, and I thought I didn't lie, and I really did. Like, I was that twisted. I was that confused. And I was scared to death on my fourth step, and I went to somebody because, you know, I don't know about here, but I know at other places there's a lot of hype about the fourth step, like, oh, my God, you're on the fourth step, like, you're going to die, you're going to relapse, you know, and, like, the thing I like to point out about that step is that in our book, this is what I recovered by, the literature. This is our program. And in the book it says, those who do not work these steps relapse. And it also says, the steps are only guarantee against relapse. And if I look up the word guarantee, there's nothing left out in the word guarantee. So if I work these steps and I live these steps, I'm guaranteed not to relapse. And that book says it. I'm not saying it. It's that book. You know, and that's the message that I share, is the message that I got from the literature. You know, I shared my fifth step with a sponsor, and that's whenever I shared a lot of that stuff I said I would take to my grave with me. And my experience with that was that my sponsor shared with me that she had done the same things I did. And that was the stuff that I judged myself so, like, critically about. I was so hard on myself about everything, even about my thoughts. Like, I was more hard on myself about my thoughts, those intrusive thoughts that come out of nowhere that I have, that I don't know if anybody can relate to me, but I know I have them, and they just come out of nowhere, and I'm like, why would I think something like that? And I told my sponsor about that, about, you know, having those thoughts, and she said, well, I have them too. And I said, really? Because I had put myself over here, like I was totally separate from the rest of the world. Like, I'm the only one that experiences this stuff, you know. And I told her exactly what the thoughts were. And she said, you know, you don't have to kill yourself over your thoughts. I mean, they come, and what you do with them is what matters. Like, you might get a thought, like, in the middle of the day, like, a thought about using. But it doesn't mean you have to use. It's what you do with the thought. And then I realized that it was my action that counted. And then I went to a six step, and, you know, I found myself in a state of humility in the six step, and there's something really important in the six step, and I don't know why I'm going through the 12 steps, but I guess that's where God wants to take me, and that's what this program is anyway, so I'm just going to roll with it. When I was on the six step, I remember, and I had some clean time, and I didn't go through the steps very really fast because I wanted to be thorough. And you know, my sponsor actually had told me that I didn't need to be as really that thorough because, like, my fourth step was like 7 or 8 notebooks, like single subject notebooks. But that's how serious I was about staying here. I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to go out there and live that life that I lived anymore. So I filled all those notebooks up, and she was like, okay, this is going to take some time. But eventually we went over it, and it was fine. But with the sixth step, I remember I found myself in a situation that was very, very humbling. And because I had acted out on some behaviors again, and it had to do with impulsive attention-seeking behaviors. And I was primed for that because I found out in the fourth step that I always wanted to stand out. When I was around people, I wanted to be the one in the crowd that stood out. Like my sponsor said, everybody around is wearing gray and Tammy's wearing red. You know, like that. I was that person. Like I always wanted to stand out like that. And not anymore, but thank God. But I had done something because of my attention-seeking behaviors that was, and it was very unhealthy, and I couldn't figure out why I had done something like that again. And in the sixth step, I remember it said about that some of us may feel very disappointed to have a substantial amount of clean time and have acted out on the same defect once again. But we must remember that humility is the ideal state for the addict. And that's where that step started to make sense to me. You know, I was supposed to be, like, we have to exhaust our defects and come to that state of humility where we're ready to surrender before we're ready to have God remove them. And that's where I was at. And then from the seventh step on, I know my sponsor didn't have me write them. She said that she wanted me to practice them. Well, the eighth step I wrote because it was a list. But from the seventh step on, aside from the eighth step, she just wanted me to live. And I did. And I called her every time a life experience came up in the seventh step. And I wasn't humble and I wasn't patient and I wasn't trusting and I didn't have enough faith. Because those were the spiritual principles that I needed in those steps. And she would remind me that, like, I'm not the one in charge, you know, and that there was a bigger plan for me than what I could see with my own eye. And she had me put sticky notes all over my car, all over my house. They were everywhere I went, just reminding me, you know, about myself not being in control. And how I needed to remember to surrender whenever a behavior would, when I felt like acting out on one of those old behaviors. And I found out through the steps that my biggest problem was like self-centered fear. Like I was scared to death of everybody and everything. I carried myself like I wasn't. I carried myself like I was tough back in the day. Some people may remember that. She's not listening, but anyway, I carried myself like I was very tough. Very, like, I got the comment on the way, in the car on the way here, saying, I remember Tammy from a couple years ago, and she was really ghetto. Like, could you picture Tammy being ghetto? And I was like, what? And she reminded me, like, how I used to dress, and wear the Tims, and wear the, you know, the sweatsuits, and all, and before Tammy knew who she was. And I remember that. Like, I was really, really, and I was really rough on the outside. Like, in my dealing with other people, I didn't know how to be loving and caring. I didn't learn that until, like, when I wrote out the eighth step and I realized all the shit that I had done and everything that I was guilty of and all the people that I had harmed, that's when I realized, like, how can I be so judgmental of other people? You know, that spirit of forgiveness started to come to me because, like, I was the most judgmental person I had ever met. I was bad. And I would actually sit in NA meetings and just look at people. And, I mean, I was very judgmental. Like, I know why they use, and I know why they use, and I don't understand why I'm here, you know. But I know why they're here, and it's good for them, you know. Like, I would just totally just judge everybody for everything. And when I wrote out that eighth step, that was another humbling experience. Wow, the steps are very humbling. And the ninth step, I move forward to make the amends only when to do so will not hurt me or hurt the other person. And there were a lot of amends. I was just talking to my sister-in-law this morning. She, you know, I'm trying to get this job at this one place, and there's somebody who works there who was married to my brother. And it would be funny if I got hired, but it wouldn't be funny because, you know, I know that God aligns us to make our amends when it's time. And my sponsor had taught me that timing is essential, you know. And it may not be in my time, but I may run into that person like a few years down the road from now, and it may be time for me to make amends. And I think I'm about to run into that person. And it's going to be interesting. But my sister-in-law said, have you made amends? I said, just living amends. And she called me on the phone because she's in recovery too. And she's like, you can't just make living amends. And I said, you don't understand. I was in New Jersey for 2 years. Well, how was I going to make amends to her while I was in another state? You know, but I come back and she's like, oh, okay, I just want to make sure you get it. I'm like, yeah, I get it. I get it. So some of the amends, like, I just had somebody come to me. It's funny. Facebook is really funny because I had somebody come to me recently who was from my active addiction asking me, well, since you're home now, how did they know I'm home? Their daughter told them, I think. Well, since you're home now, can I get that $225 you owe me? And I'm like, that was from 10 years ago. Like, you burnt me and I burnt you. And now you're asking me to pay the money back. I'm like, that's not even who I am. So I just kind of, like, ignored it. Because those are the amends that require a living amends. Like, I'm not going to go back to this guy and say, yeah, you know, hey, drug dealer, here, have your money back. And, like, I'm going to put myself in that situation where everybody's using. I'm not going to do that, you know, because I'm not going to hurt me today. And I'm not going to tell him where I live either. Because he's still in a lifestyle. I'm not. But a lot of the amends, my amends were living amends because I couldn't, you know, staying clean. Clean time speaks for itself. That's what our book says. Clean time speaks for itself. People say clean time don't matter. Well, the longer we stay clean and away from those behaviors, the more we experience forgiveness, you know. And like my mom, that'll bring me up to today, definitely. I live with my mother, and wow, I lived with my mother years ago, came here, moved out on my own, kind of. She bought a house, and there was another house, and she gave me the other house that was on the property, and said, live here for the rest of your life. But I can't live like that, you know, because I have to know that I'm independent. She says, well, you don't have to pay rent, you don't have to pay this, you don't have to do that. It would be nice to live off mom for the rest of my life, but it doesn't feel good, you know, that I'm living off mom. So I did that for a while. Then when I went to Jersey, I got married. I met this nice NA relationship I had. I met this nice NA man. He had 20-some years clean. And I had 3.5, I think. And he was going to save my life. He was going to be like my personal savior, and I put him up here on this pedestal. And like, I was married to him for like, I don't know, wow, 2.5 years? And, it started going downhill, and then I don't remember what happened. I mean, it was just everything happened so fast from there, but it was a hell of an experience to be in a situation with somebody who had that amount of clean time. And, like, I was in a car accident when I was out there. I had to have 10 surgeries on my back, you know, while I was there. So they like to prescribe medication for surgeries, and I don't like to take it. So, you know, I just saw it fit to put the medication in the medicine cabinet and leave it at that. And when I woke up from the surgery one of the days, and from the anesthesia, and I was in a lot of pain. And I was talking to my sponsor, and she was like, maybe you need to take your medication, like, you're not God, you know, and you're not going to, like, make yourself not be in pain, and you're in touch, and you're, you know, reaching out to people. It's not like you're going to relapse. Like, just take your freaking medication. And I went to take it, and it was gone. And having somebody on a pedestal like that, with like 20-some years clean, you know, and then they use. Because I asked him, and he told me the truth. But he didn't use. And that was the hard part for me. Like, okay, you took them because your back was in pain, like, but you didn't call a doctor, and you took mine. And I woke up from surgery with nothing, and that was very painful. But the relationship was painful before that. And I signed myself up for a lot of it because I fell in love with an image in NA. An NA image, a convention speaker. Yeah. Circuit speaker. Go marry him and everything will be okay. You know, and I signed up for a lot of the pain that I received, and some of it I did not sign up for. All I knew was that it had come to an end. I wasn't going to save him. He was never going to admit that he did anything wrong to me, and I had to make a decision. And like that decision involved me throwing away everything that I owned, everything I had built in recovery. But I remembered the third step. I think it's in It Works, Helen Wine. It says some of us find ourselves jobless, penniless, and homeless in recovery, but we don't have to use if we turn our will over to a higher power, you know. And I left that relationship and had a lot of insecurities after that. And like I had been through the full 12 steps with a sponsor, like 10th step, like continuously looking at myself, trying to correct myself because I did a lot of things in the relationship too, you know. I can't just tell his side of the story. You know, I have a side to the story and I had a part to play in it too, and I had to look at the things that I did, you know. And the 11th step, the finding that spiritual path, and I had a spiritual path from having an 11th step, and my sponsor, she lives in Pittsburgh, she kept me on the 11th step for like a year. And I was like, when can I move past the 11th step? And she's like, I don't know. Just stay on it. Good for you just to stay on it. And I understood why after a while, because like whatever life happened and I had to seek, you know, consistently seek that conscious contact. And like conscious contact means like, conscious means aware. And contact means connected. So in my awareness, I am connected to what? A higher power, a power greater than myself, to God. I'm connected when I'm conscious. That means when I wake up, I become connected with God. And when I go to bed and I sleep until I wake up again, I am connected with God. And I have to know that continually. Like, and I have to remind myself of that too. Because I forget. Like, in this job search I've been going through, like, seriously, I forget. I have a criminal history, you know, like, I need to share this because this is hope. Like, when I came here, I dropped out of college twice. I flunked out of college. Like, I didn't even go. I didn't even, like, care. And I went back to school in recovery. And I got a master's degree. And I pulled out my transcript the other day when I'm looking for jobs. And I was so proud, I handed it to my mom. And I was like, they would be stupid not to hire me because of a criminal history, because look. And I had never really sat down and looked at my transcript, but every grade on there except for one class was an A, except for one B+. And my mom's like, and that was a B+, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, you know, and I'm like, I was condemning myself because I went to a lot of interviews after I came back here, and I got turned down for a lot of jobs, and it doesn't feel good whenever you've been clean for like 7.5 years and you've been trying to do the right thing and walk the spiritual path and, you know, live the steps and la-da-da, all the good stuff, you know, that we do in recovery, and we get degrees and we move on in life. And like coming from a job where I was making $25 an hour in New Jersey, 40 hours a week, full-time, benefits, everything, and I had everything, to coming here and making $0 an hour and having problems finding a job, because I have a criminal history. When they didn't care in New Jersey, they didn't care. You know, but that's about to come to an end too, and I'm going to speak it, I'm going to say it, because it is. You know, I went to 2 interviews on Friday, and they didn't care. You know, they were like, what human service professional doesn't have a criminal history? And I'm like, okay, so you get it. Good, I'm glad. And they pay more than I made in New Jersey, so I'm like, but that's a part-time position. And I'm looking for full-time. But it's going to happen the way God wants it to happen. My experience is I've lost jobs in recovery before. And what happens is, like, God offers me, like, 3 at once, and I have to pick. And I don't like being in that position, so that's why he does that, I think. Because then I have to pick, and I have to say, well, you know, weigh out the options. And there's a lot of options to weigh out with all, like, 3 positions that I'm considering now. But that's what happens whenever we stay clean and continue to move forward. Like, somebody shared with me the other day that the last thing that we lose in recovery is the stigma of being an addict, and I hadn't experienced that for years because in Jersey they didn't care. They wanted a body with a degree. That's what they wanted. You know, they wanted to fill positions. They needed people. And here, like, they scrutinize you. Like, wow. Even for, a drug and alcohol counselor position, you know, and that's what I was trying to do. That's what I'm trying to do. And, well, you can't have a criminal history. Well, okay. I have comments about that, but I'll keep to myself. But so in the 12th step is about giving back to me. It's about showing up for stuff like this. Like, I had something happen this morning. My son is 17. He was an active addict when he was 15. I took him to Jersey with me. I didn't take him to Jersey with me. I went there. I didn't have my kids. I lost my kids. No, I gave my kids to their dads and let them raise them because of my addiction. And they were okay with it. But the one dad isn't so stable himself. And I never have to worry about my youngest son. But my oldest I do, because he doesn't have a spiritual foundation in his life. And I took him out to Jersey with me because he called me one day and he said, "Mom, I fell. I passed out. My wrist is paralyzed. Woke up in someone's driveway and I don't know who. And I don't know what happened." And he was 15. And I got a check from the school that week. That's the way God works. He puts things in our lives right when it's time and not before, not after. And I sent the lawyer a check, and without a hearing, now, Miss Criminal History, former addict, without a hearing, they gave me my son. And took him out there to Jersey, put him through rehab. He got clean, got out, relapsed the next day. Thank God I have a program. You know, because here's my son, like, I'm trying to get into my apartment, and he won't answer the door, and he's, like, passed out in the bedroom, and nobody knows if he's dead or alive. He OD'd on me. He OD'd on himself, actually. I guess he saw it fit to look up online depression medication that his mother was taking, and when I left the house, take it all. And he OD'd. But he lived. But he has no recollection of 3 days. He lost 3 whole days. You know, and seeing a 15-year-old going through that is, like, not fun. And then he was able to do his stuff that he had to do in treatment and come out and tell me his story. And wow, like, he's a lot further along on the path of addiction than I was at that age. And I could see the progression. I could see it in him. And we came, you know, he got clean. He stayed clean in Jersey after that, got involved with really healthy stuff, and then we moved back here. And this is where his old friends are from. And, like, last night, I'm coming up here with all this on my mind, right? Last night, he told me he was going to his dad's. So all night last night, I'm comfortable in the fact that my son is at his father's house. And his father calls me this morning and says, "Where's Ian?" And I said, "Now I'm really confused, because he said that he was with you." And I trusted him, you know, because we gained that trust back in recovery. And, you know, my son gained some back from me, but he just lost it. I don't know where he is. He's 17. And we've tried everything to find him, short of a missing person report, which is next. And I think that he'll surface before that happens, because I told him that's going to happen. And like, his dad is still trying to find him right now. And then I have this commitment, and I'm thinking, what do I do? You know, I don't know any of his, I don't know his friends from here. I don't know where they live. His dad knows all those people. So I called his dad, and I said, "Dad, you know, help. Do you have these people's numbers? Well, you'll have to look them up in the phone book." And I was like, "Okay, they're not in the phone book. They're not on Facebook. You know, they're nowhere." So, you know, then I have to drive up here and speak, and I'm thinking, well, what do I do? Do I stay here at home and cry about my son and be lost, and I have no idea where he's at, and he's not going to service until he's ready to service because he's in his process? Or do I move forward and, like, come up here and like, carry a message? And hopefully by the time I'm done, he will have called. But, so my choice was to surrender, because I know when I was 17 and when I was doing what I wanted to do, my mom wasn't going to find me. So what am I going to do? Drive myself crazy, you know, out there running around looking for him? And, like, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, I love my son. I can't make him get clean. I can't make him stay clean. And it's funny living with another person that you know is like just like you, because it makes me so angry sometimes whenever I look at him, because he acts just like me. And when I was his age. But I always have to remember, like, his dad said to me on the phone, "What were you doing when you were 17? Like, I already had Ian when I was 15. And I was out running around, you know, trying to get one more. So, I guess, but for the grace of God, you know. And all I can do is continue to live the life that I'm living, and hopefully he'll get a message. You know, I've seen kids that have been raised in NA that go out and use, you know, and that's like my son. Like, come on, you were raised in the meetings, but he doesn't care because he's self-centered right now, but like, I have something that I can do, and that's lead by example and be a leader in his life. But I'm not going to exhaust myself either and drive myself insane. So I hope I was able to carry a message of recovery. Like, this program is about spiritual principles. It's about learning how to grow up, you know, and grow up with God. And that coming from somebody who had no sense of a God in the past, it's really a transformation. But that's what these steps do. They transform us from the creepy, crawly creatures that we used to be into beautiful people who are capable of doing a lot of things with their lives. Like, I'm in school now for a doctorate degree, and I'm going to graduate in 2 years. And like, when I came into recovery, my goal was to get clean and hopefully get an associate's degree, and that's all I wanted to do. Like, because all that other stuff was really foreign and really scary. And I think about it now sometimes, and I'm like, wow. It's like, it's the power of God. You know, once I stay humbled and I stay surrendered, you know, like, seven and a half years clean, a year in for my doctorate degree. Wow. From the person that I used to be. It's just amazing. And like my mom, like I said, I live with my mom. She gives me the keys to her house. Like, watch the house, watch the dogs, do this, do that, you know, like, she doesn't even care. She told me the other day, "I used to lock everything up whenever you came over. Now everything is unlocked." I said, "Well, thanks. You didn't have to tell me that, but not that I want to go look, because I don't even have a desire." Like, my mom drinks, seriously, my mom drinks, and she drinks every night, and that's her choice. But I have a choice, you know, and the world is not going to stop using because I stop using. And when I was in New York, that was a big lesson, because I hated the drug dealer that was on the corner right next to the halfway house, that every time I walked down the door, he would follow me down the street and give me his number, try to give me his number. And I hated him, and my sponsor taught me, like, well, if, you know, and I was like, well, how do I know I'm not going to use? There's a dealer right on the corner. And she said, "Recovery is your choice." And that gave me the strength to come home with my mother, you know, and yeah, she drinks, she does what she does, but like, it doesn't even faze me. It doesn't even bother me. I'll be excited to be on my own again. I got an apartment. That's good. And the job is next, and a lot of healing. I'm single now for the first time in my life for almost 2 months. That's amazing. That's amazing for me, because I have jumped in and out of relationships from the time that I was 13, not from the time that I got clean, mind you. I've been doing this since I was 13. Jumping and jumping and jumping and having two or three relationships and wondering why they didn't work out at the same time, but they're all there at the same time. I wonder why. And then jumping and jumping and jumping and jumping and never giving myself time for me. And like, what I'm noticing about myself, like, now is that I can cry and I have feelings, and I'm not stuffing anything on top of those feelings. Like, since I've come back home, I've had a lot of feelings. I've had a lot of emotional days. I've cried all day on some days. Sometimes I know why. Sometimes I don't know why. And like, God has given me a second chance at life and at a lot of things. Like, I never got a chance to raise my children. and be a mother because I gave them up because of my addiction. And I'm gonna have a baby, and that's really exciting. Because, and although the father is not gonna be there, because he was another person from an NA meeting that I met and thought was gonna be good for me. My mom told me my picker is broke. And my friend from Indiana told me just stop picking. So, and I stopped picking. I let God pick, you know, because, like, I don't do well for myself whenever I pick people that I think I'm supposed to be with. I don't, but, and I'll share about that situation really quick and what brought me back to New Jersey, just because it's necessary that we know that, like, not everybody in the rooms is here for recovery. Not everybody at an NA meeting is there for an NA meeting. And you really got to watch, because I heard somebody in Allentown share once, because I've been all over the place in NA because I was with the circuit speaker and it was everywhere. And but I heard this lady in Allentown speak about, you know, being careful about who you get with in NA because they might want to be with your child and not with you. You know, and I always, like, I was like, that woman is insane. Why would she say something like that? You know, and my experience is that when I left my husband in New Jersey, I was hurting so bad and I just wanted to jump into whatever was there. And I jumped into this relationship with this guy, and I was with him for about a year. He had 16 years clean, and he relapsed. And he overdosed, and he lived. And I found out I was pregnant, and we moved. And then he said, I have to go to the police station and register. And I said, register what? You figure it out. And the only reason that I say that is because, like, we could be sitting beside somebody in a meeting and think we know them and we know everything about them, but be with them for a year and then this stuff comes out and it's like, what the hell do I do now? You know, I looked at my son, I said, pack your stuff. When he goes to work, pack your stuff, we're leaving, we're going home. Called my mom and she said, you can come home anytime. She never wants me to leave now. Before, I couldn't even get in her door when I was using. And now she doesn't want me to leave. She's like, even now, just stay here until you have the baby. You don't have to move out. You don't need a job. I'm like, Mom, who's going to pay my car payment? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? You know, she's like, she loves me to death, and she hated me. She didn't hate me, but she totally shut me down in my act of addiction. And to have that relationship back in my life means so much to me, because she's a beautiful person, and, like, her getting her master's degree is what gave me the hope to get mine. And then an NA member, when I was in the fourth step and scared to death, said to me, the fourth step is a turning point. It is not a point where you're going to fail. It's a turning point in your life. And in the fourth step, I enrolled myself back into college, you know. And, like, that's my experience with the steps. I continue to work the steps. I still have a sponsor. She lives in Pittsburgh. She's been my sponsor for about, 5.5 years. I don't know. I stopped counting. But she's been a constant in my life. You know, I met her because, here's how I met my sponsor. I was voted as the RCM at the area here years ago, remember? And I had to go to Pittsburgh to the regional committee, to the regional meetings, and my sponsor was the chair. And every time I went there, she like had all this food laid out on the table. She was feeding everybody and always so, you know, just happy to see people, most people. And she was just always so kind to me. And that's how I met her, was from being in service. And I say that to say that when we give in this program, we receive. Like, if I wasn't committed to a service position myself and to giving back to help the next sick and suffering addict, I wouldn't have found a sponsor. And who knows from there, because I can't live sponsorless, you know. It's two things I can't do is live godless and sponsorless, because without those two, like, I'm destined to fail. And I don't even want to try it. So I love this woman to death. And she was my sponsor before I left for Jersey, when I was in Jersey, and when I came back to Jersey. Or came back from Jersey and came back here. Like, she's still my sponsor. Like, I just took her with me everywhere I went. And I wish he could be here today, but that day will come. I don't see her much, but I talk to her an awful lot. And I talk to her voicemail a lot, and that feels good just to be able to get things out, because when I go through things, like, sometimes she's not always available, but just leaving that message on her machine makes me feel better, you know? And then she gets back to me. So, like, this program works. It works if we... The key is it works if we want it to work. But we have to get real with ourselves and ask ourselves, do we really want it to work? And then when we want it to work, to be ready for some stuff, because life doesn't stop because we get clean, we say the serenity prayer at the end of meetings, and we pray for wisdom to know the difference. I was talking to Art the other day, and the funny thing is, like, about the serenity prayer, like, we say it at the end of every meeting, but do we really know what we're saying? Because we're asking for wisdom to know the difference. How do we get wisdom to know the difference? Through life, through experience, through struggle. That's the only way I learned spiritual principles, was through struggle. You know, now I'm not motivated as much by pain. When I first came here, that was my motivator for recovery, was pain. I had enough pain. Now I'm motivated to grow more spiritually. And that happens eventually, but it takes time. You know, and I hope I was able to carry a message. I think I did. And if I did, it was all God, because I prayed first, and I learned that in my steps, always to pray first. And I hope everybody has fun, and it's an honor to be asked to speak at any NA event, especially in this area where I know people and where people have seen me grow up, because people saw me when I was that scared little girl when I came in. So see me now is really a tremendous difference. And thank you again. That's all I have.